Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 350th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You can get your daily reading from me and other writers over at Once a Metro and also the rest of the SB Nation family of soccer websites. Come on in. Chat room is open. You can talk amongst yourselves if you like. Pardon me. Or if you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my ability. There is continued discussion about the situation, of course, involving the Columbus Crew. It looks like the league, MLS, as well as Mr. Precourt, are not budging. They are not budging at all. They are not moving from their stance. It looks like that the Crew will be moving to Austin, Texas, whether everyone likes it or not, but still, though, the discussion is raging. I'm enjoying this Twitter discussion between some Cosmos fan and Secret Six. One Secret Six are his Twitter handle is secret_611. So it's always going to be about the money, maybe so, but still, it doesn't make it right for what the Mr. Precourt and the league and MLS is trying to do to find ways to make it right about moving this club out of Columbus, Ohio to Austin, Texas. In fact, I'd love to see the situation here that everyone in Austin, even though they're probably saying that, some are saying, well, we'll come to see MLS, but I think for those in Austin, I think it'd be smart, in my opinion, of course, not to go into these games, even though I don't want to go against MLS. But the point is, this has just been a big travesty. And part of this argument has been, and this is from Dan Perlman. Now, Mr. Perlman is a NBC4 reporter in Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, he posted this 8 hours ago on Twitter, at Dan Perlman, DanPerlman, on Twitter. A reliable source close to negotiations to save the Crew informed me MLS and Crew leadership management told Columbus leaders that the city could apply for an expansion team if Crew leaves town. And now Mr. Perlman is awaiting response from the league and the team. So basically what I'm understanding now is that they have decided to allow a move from Columbus to Austin, the Crew, which would be no money down or anything. But if Columbus wants to bring back a club, if they want to bring back a club to play at Crew Stadium, Mapfre Stadium, whatever you want to call it now, that the city has to pony up expansion fee. Why does Columbus have to pony up an expansion fee? Or at least a team? When, you know, the whole San Jose situation happened, we knew then, you know, San Jose wasn't doing well. They knew it because they weren't not in a good situation. And now they have Avaya when they made the return. But still, though, I would like to see something happen here where you need to see what is going on with this Columbus Crew side, and it's just been an absolute disgusting display of not caring, not showing a backbone because you don't care. How about you know, giving them an opportunity. But there is no opportunity, is there? Because the league will probably say, well, we've given Columbus 22 years. That should have been enough. You intentionally have this stadium as the main crux of Dos Azero, where it was born. This whole situation with the Columbus Crew, with Mr. Anthony Precourt, it's just absolutely ridiculous. If MLS was really serious about having the Crew remaining in Columbus, they should have worked with the ownership groups. They should have worked with the Hunts. They should have had a serious conversation with everyone within Columbus, but no. No, that's not going to happen, will it? Because it's always been about the bottom line. No, this is what the bottom line is all about, folks. The bottom line is that if there was a real issue with the situation of Crew Stadium, the real situation with anything and everything that's involving about this, you know, the financial moments and the financial situations going on, then maybe there should have been some form of discussion. You know, I don't know what goes on in the league offices in Manhattan, in New York City. I don't know. I don't want to pretend I do know because I don't. But what I have seen so far, and it's really very simply put, the league does not care about Columbus. You know, these conversations, the Twitter arguments that I'm seeing right now, yes, I've said it myself. Money makes the world go round, and I understand that. I'm a firm believer of it. But when you're seeing these smaller towns outside the cities of England and how they have survived, thrived, and they're doing so well right now. What about, you know, and I know if I say it, you know, that's part of the reasons why we have to have it. But once again, you know, there is more issues involved in that than what I believe, you know. I'm not saying I don't want it, like I've always said already. I'm not saying I don't want it. I'm saying there's more issues, and ProRail will not fix it all by itself. It won't. But as I have maintained in my beliefs, every club needs a stadium. MLS has gone away from, and I'll say it because I'm not afraid to say it, MLS has gone away from the type of stadiums that need to be built. Small stadiums are the way to start off. 25,000 should be more than 30,000. It's up to the owners. I mean, look, let's just say for right now, if Atlanta United ever built their own stadium, and of course it's, we know that Mercedes-Benz Stadium is owned by the Atlanta Falcons, who also own Atlanta United, and I give plenty of respect to everyone in Atlanta that has done the amazing thing, and that is to support their club and the game. But let me just say this. If Arthur Blank truly built his own soccer stadium and actually make it kind of like what, you know, into a stadium that, not saying, you know, they wouldn't be proud of, but still though, I mean, look what they did. They filled up Bobby Dodd Stadium, which is a college football stadium. And that is unbelievable. But I have to say this, and we'll continue this towards the end of the interviews that I'm going to have today with my guests, but let me just say this. I truly believe that Atlanta could absolutely have an over 30 to 40,000 seat stadium with the same amount of fans that support their club over in downtown Atlanta. I think they can do it because that's how strongly I do believe in what they're doing in Atlanta. So that's just my opinion. But let's go ahead now, folks. Great show for you tonight. Neil Morris will join me to talk about the move of North Carolina FC from the NASL to the USL now. Joining me on a recorded interview is the UCLA professor that is well known in law department of things at the UCLA, the law professor from UCLA, in a recorded interview from Los Angeles, California, Professor Stephen Bank, who will discuss the NASL U.S. soccer lawsuit. Here's that recorded interview right now. Daniel Feuerstein here, the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show, as we talk more about what's going on in our leagues here in the United States. Joining me right now is a UCLA law professor, Mr. Professor Stephen Bank. He'll update us on the current situation with the NASL's lawsuit against U.S. Soccer for the Division II sanctioning. Professor Bank, thank you for your time and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Daniel. Good to be here. So the lawsuit that NASL filed is an antitrust lawsuit against U.S. Soccer, claiming that U.S. Soccer had unlawfully conspired with the other affiliates of U.S. Soccer, MLS, USL, Soccer United Marketing, to keep NASL from either D2 sanctioning or really D1 sanctioning, from a level of competition with Major League Soccer. So that's where the lawsuit started. The initial complaint argued two strategies in the courtroom. One was for a preliminary injunction, and the other was a permanent injunction. The preliminary injunction is the only one that's been litigated at all to this point, and they wanted the court to declare that there was sufficient likelihood of success in the merits in order for the court to order a stop to U.S. Soccer's decision to not grant D2 status for next season. NASL lost that argument in the district court, and they've appealed it to the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. And so right now we're in the briefing period. NASL asked for an expedited briefing schedule. They filed their brief. U.S. Soccer on Monday filed its response brief, and assuming the briefing schedule stays to form, NASL will have a reply brief due this coming Monday, and then a hearing scheduled for December 15th, an oral argument. So a little bit of a side technical detail, NASL, in somewhat of an odd move, asked for an extension of time to file the reply brief, which is an odd thing when you've moved for an expedited briefing schedule. But that hasn't been ruled on, so presumably, if everything stays according to plan, we'll see their reply on Monday. And so where we are is that NASL's really in the kind of, not desperation mode, but they're really scrambling a little bit legally. They didn't win the preliminary injunction. It's an uphill battle to win an appeal of a denial of preliminary injunction, in part because a preliminary injunction is a request for the court to provide relief before you've proven you deserve relief. And so that's a high burden that the court's going to impose before they're going to let you do that. And an appeal of a denial of preliminary injunction requires the plaintiff, in this case NASL, to demonstrate the court abused its discretion, that there was clear factual and legal error, which is why most of the arguments in the appellate brief are not about factual error, because it's pretty rare for the appellate court to overturn the district court on facts, and more about legal error. So it's a lot of technical legal arguments.
Yeah.
All of that. So that's where we are. It's kind of an illegal, a little bit of technical legal stance right now. Still a...
No, absolutely. And one thing I think is interesting is that when it comes to this situation that we are in with the NASL, it talks about, or shall I say, when they tried to settle it out of court, the NASL decided not to take the advice, I guess, from U.S. Soccer for the one-year extension to becoming Division II, and they decide to, I guess, continue through the courts.
Well, so, yeah, so, and now we're all going off rumors here. I don't know that anybody's officially said, here was the settlement offer, and here's why we rejected it. So, but the rumor was that they were sort of heading towards a settlement. And I've got to tell you that in litigation, you always should be heading towards a settlement. You always should be talking about settlement. There's very few circumstances where litigation is better than a settlement. And one of the few circumstances where it makes sense to continue to litigate is when you're dealing with like a customer litigation issue, which could precipitate thousands of other customers to come forward and sue on the same issue. So you really don't want, but otherwise you'd rather settle the thing. So. U.S. Soccer, apparently, there was some thought NASL had agreed to a deal that was going to be 3 years at Division II, give NASL a chance to figure out its status, at least, get its bearings, get some of the teams in financial shape, and then they'd be able to proceed. Now, there's a couple things that are odd about that report of the settlement offer. The preliminary injunction they're seeking, which they lost on, would have only given them 1 year. So the idea that U.S. Soccer was offering them a free pass for 3 years to settle the possibility of a suit that was, wasn't really going to give them that 1 year is a little odd. The permanent injunction that U.S. Soccer was facing, potentially, if NASL won the ultimate suit, would remove all the divisional sanctioning. So there is some notion that, oh, wow, that's a pretty onerous end result, but NASL would probably be out of business by then if they continued to stick to their plan of D2 or nothing. So there's some notion that it's going to be 3 years and that U.S. Soccer proposed 1 year. I suspect there that it was never really a guaranteed 3 years. It was, if you do these things, we'll essentially waive these other conditions for 3 years. So we'll waive, like, the number of teams for 3 years, but the teams still have to meet certain minimal standards, or something like that, that where there's no meeting of the minds. That's the legal phrase often used. It's why you have to write things down. You know, we say A, you say you hear B, and everybody thinks we got an agreement, but then when you write it down, you realize we don't. So there was no meeting of the minds problem. There's the other potential hang-up in the settlement that was reported is that U.S. Soccer was insisting on some kind of a permanent ban or indefinite ban on NASL suing the U.S. Soccer on antitrust grounds. Now, that sounds bad to kind of the non-legal observer. Well, that just seems unfair. But you have to understand what is going on here and what probably was U.S. Soccer was asking for, at least just my kind of no inside knowledge, but just observation. So what NASL is alleging is that U.S. Soccer conspired by, or acted in concert with its affiliates by voting down the Professional League Standard classification of D2 for NASL, and that restrained trade. So you could settle the lawsuit without what is called a covenant not to sue in the future. You could just settle it. On this case, we're settling it. But then next year, when they apply on the same exact grounds with no better circumstances, and U.S. Soccer says, no, you didn't meet the conditions, you're out, they would sue again on antitrust grounds because we only agreed to settle what happened in the past. This is future. And so U.S. Soccer has to get in a settlement agreement some kind of covenant not to sue that you're not going to, on these exact same grounds, come back to us and sue again. It's got to be like you agree that there'd have to be something additional beyond just what we've already been doing this whole time. And so if that sounds onerous to NASL, then they don't quite understand the basis for a settlement. A settlement should be, okay, we're not going to sue you on this ground. Something new would have to happen. And new can't just be the same exact facts 1 year in the future. So I think there may be some misunderstanding. It also may be that U.S. Soccer's willingness to settle is much less than NASL assumed it was. But sometimes you can overestimate how strong your case really is or how strong your leverage is. And the assumption, I think, that's being made by NASL is that the leverage is based not on winning the appeal, because that's a hard case to win, not even on winning the ultimate case, because it's hard to win any antitrust case, let alone a permanent injunction that would strip U.S. Soccer of its right to serve basically as a standard-setting organization. But the discovery process that would go forward if the case proceeded. And that assumes that U.S. Soccer is really worried about discovery. Maybe they're worried mildly about it. Maybe not as much as NASL assumes. So it's hard to know, but oftentimes the parties don't have the same view of the leverage involved.
This is the one thing that I would like to ask you, because I find it interesting that U.S. Soccer does raise interesting points on this irreparable injury. Now, obviously, NASL has some form of contract with the National Premier Soccer League, NPSL, of these letters of intent that some of these clubs, and I think Detroit City FC is one of those clubs that were looking to make a move to the NASL for second division, that they were manufactured. Now, and irreparable injury, basically. Now, what does that mean? And does that mean that could there also be some sort of a fine against clubs that were trying to be either making these moves, or was this all by the NASL? What was this entail?
So here's how this all comes up. One of the criteria for getting a preliminary injunction, there are four criteria. One of them is that you have to show that the plaintiff has to show that in the absence of the granted relief, the preliminary injunction, they would suffer irreparable injury. The argument NASL has made in the lower court is the irreparable injury is that our current teams would be able to pay exit fees much less, and they might leave if we're not D2, and that the new teams that we have solicited all have conditions in their letters of intent to join the league. That it be D2. That is, they're stipulating we will not join the league if it's not D2. Now, here's the interesting part, one of the interesting aspects of this. The court ruled in NASL's favor. The district court ruled in NASL's favor. So in the appellate court, the reason that U.S. Soccer brings the issue back up is in part because of a very technical standard of proof or standard of proof at the lower court issue relating to whether this is a mandatory injunction or a prohibitory injunction, which mandatory injunction is what the court held. That has a higher standard, but there's an exception if there's an extreme damages. And NASL says we have this huge irreparable injury, which is the equivalent of an extreme damage. So they're still arguing the irreparable injury point, even though the district court had said NASL would suffer it. What U.S. Soccer then is essentially acting like they're the ones appealing by saying in their appellate brief, hey, we think the district court got it wrong on irreparable injury. We don't even think there's irreparable injury. Why? Because you're not allowed to say, for example, we will go out of business if the relief isn't granted. You say, why will you go out of business? Because this clause says we'll go out of business. Who put in the clause? We did. So we sort of manufactured the irreparable injury. It wasn't real. The problem with the letters of intent is they all, according to U.S. Soccer's brief, the response brief and the appeal, all had identical or near identical language on this condition, which suggests that NASL told them here, or NASL even wrote the letters of intent, right, drafted it. And there's a lot of intuitive, persuasive quality to this, because these NPSL teams are semi-pro teams. They're by no means ready for a jump to Division II when they were not even Division III. They're probably Division, you know, there's no such thing as Division IV, but if there was, there would be Division IV or V or something like that. And so the idea that we won't become professional if we can't become professional at D2 is a little curious. Why would they care? I mean, you could understand why New York Cosmos would care. The owner of the New York Cosmos or the owner of Miami FC have sunk a lot of money in. They don't want to drop down, lose all that sunk cost. But why would NPSL teams that up till now haven't really had anything, if they put in those letters of intent, they manufactured the condition that they have to be D2 or else they won't join, it casts some doubt. I don't think that will cast some doubt on the irreparable injury argument. I don't think the appellate court will do anything with that because that's a factual question, and they're likely to say abuse of discretion review. We think it's reasonable for the district court to have held that was still not that there's still irreparable injury there, and it's probably true. Probably NASL is not going to survive either way because if New York Cosmos and Miami FC, you know, decided that's it, we're out, neither of them are going to finance these NPSL teams. But it is a little squirrely to suggest that all these NPSL teams are D2 or nothing, D2 or bust. And that's what that point was making. I, like I said, legally I don't think it's going to end up with any kind of sanction, fine, impact on the case, unless it went to trial. But even at trial, it's not quite the same thing, but it might then, but right now I don't think it's going to be a huge issue, but it is an issue in the court of public opinion. It does make it look bad for NASL.
Yeah, it really does, and hopefully there'll be some form of compromise towards the end. In your best opinion, Professor, do you think the NASL survives this? Do they accept Division III, or do you think this is it? It's all over?
Well, I don't. So as far as whether they would accept D3 or some other status, I can only speculate based on what they said. There's nothing about the law that would dictate this. I could see them deciding they're going to go in with, you know, sort of jumpstart this NISA that Peter Wiltz has been pushing, or they're going to be a rogue league, although they insisted they would not do that. But realistically, I think that the strategy right now is they don't think it's realistic they're going to win the appeal. But you got to pursue the appeal. You might, so you might as well pursue it. After the appeal, the next step legally is U.S. Soccer's already provided notice that they're going to file a motion to dismiss, and there's a briefing schedule set for that. That will get revived. It's been stayed by the district court. That will get revived. That motion to dismiss could take them all the way. If the appeal is not ruled on until end of December, beginning of January, the motion to dismiss might not get ruled on until mid-February, end of February. There's no way that NASL could have all of that kind of resolved and get to discovery, get to a point where they think they have their leverage for settlement early enough to get the case going, unless they get it, you know, they got to get a settlement negotiation, you know, done much earlier. So it seems like their strategy is try to get the settlement in this sort of sweet spot window of after the appeal is ruled on and before motion to dismiss is decided. Because once motion to dismiss is decided, discovery would proceed. That's a short window. And I don't know if they'll be successful. But if they don't do that, I don't know what their plans are. We saw recently there have been announcements several clubs are leaving. I think they might be left with something like 6 clubs, including the 2 expansion teams. I'm not positive if that's official count, but not including the NPSL teams. So I don't know even if they have enough. If everybody is confident that they have enough to proceed forward beyond that, but it's a the way they're acting in the court is quite predictable. I mean, these are the steps you take, but they have to have a back strategy because litigation is not a sprint; it's a marathon, and antitrust litigation is, you know, could be a couple of year marathon. So this can't be the end result that gets them success unless everybody's willing to close the league down for 2 years or so, or a year and a half, and restart. So that's all I can predict from a legal perspective. But they certainly have made one thing legally I can say is they can't even restart as a Division III at this point because they still have to get sanctioning. That is, they didn't apply for D3 status in U.S. Soccer. So they would have to apply for sanctioning quite late. But they could. But I don't see any evidence they're planning on doing that.
I guess it's the typical expression, go big or go home. Professor Stephen Bank, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And everyone, please follow Professor Stephen Bank at Prof Bank on Twitter. He has been keeping up to date with everything with this situation. Thank you for your time, sir, and happy Thanksgiving.
Sure, you too, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Professor Stephen Bank, gentleman who is a UCLA law professor, giving the nitty-gritty and some updates about what's going on with the NASL and the USL, U.S. Soccer Federation lawsuit. It's not pretty, but it's just what is happening right now, and we'll see what happens as we wait for some more news that comes out from the courts when it comes to this situation. But joining me right now, a gentleman that you've heard many, many times on this show discussing NASL, USL, and other U.S. soccer moments, of course, it is Mr. Neil Morris from the WRALSportsFan.com. North Carolina FC is going to move to the USL in 2018. Neil, thank you again, and how was your Thanksgiving?
It was great, Daniel. I hope yours was as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I just wish I could have had the pizza after Turkey Day like you did.
Yeah, I've had pizza several times after Turkey Day. I need to go on a diet. I need to get back on the turkey diet to get off the pizza diet.
Yep. Too many carbs. Same old issue. Same old situation. So, Neil, in your opinion, if you don't mind me saying, if you don't mind me asking this, I should say, what's it going to be like when you're going to see North Carolina FC at Salem Stadium at Wake Med Soccer Park playing their first USL match and since Steve Malik has moved the club away from NASL?
What's it going to be like? I don't know. Probably a lot like the previous years, to be quite honest about it. I mean, it's I think that you know, on game day, there will be marginal differences. You know, if you're playing some sort of regional competitor like Charlotte or Charleston or Richmond, you can maybe look for a little bit more rambunctiousness from both the home and visiting supporters. Fans can travel a little more, so there'll be a little bit more juice when it comes to the supporters' culture, I suppose. I do wonder, I've always wondered whether to the casual fan who are influenced by many different things, whether the cachet of playing teams from New York or Miami or Indianapolis or San Francisco, whether there's a diminished cachet when you start talking about playing teams from markets that aren't quite as big, and then the casual fan who doesn't track the leagues as much as we do. So I do wonder a little bit about that, and of course maybe that's a little bit of trepidation from the old USL days, which is when I first started writing, was back in 2009, which was the Carolina Railhawks' last year in USL before they broke off. To help form the new NASL. So I guess on a game day, it won't feel that much different other than you'll be playing different teams than usual. I think where it will feel different is between games and between seasons where, although covering the drama surrounding the NASL is a lot of fun, there's also something to be said on an individual club basis for stability and predictability, and that'll be interesting to see how the club and the fans embrace that. I mean, the Carolina franchise is one that has seen a fair amount of turbulence over its history. So, some is self-imposed, some not, and you know, to finally have the league situation, at least in Carolina, settled relatively early in the off season is something that hasn't been enjoyed for quite a while. So that'll be interesting. I think that is where the difference will be, is that there won't be sort of this underlying tumult. You won't be playing the same team, you know, 4 to 6 times like last year. So I think that is where the difference will be. But, you know, after a while, games are games and competitors are competitors, and it kind of evens out after a while.
I really don't want to throw this out at you, but I might as well, because I know you just reported it or you made a comment on it on Twitter with North Carolina FC owner Steve Malik. The NASL, I don't know if this is from – well, I guess it is from Interim Commissioner Rishi Siegel. He's asked the U.S. Soccer Federation to remove Steve Malik from the board of directors and replace him with an individual who can fairly represent the NASL. Has it gone to that level where the NASL is very, very dissatisfied with Mr. Malik? I don't know if they have a claim to it, but what do you know?
Well, has it come to that level? Oh, clearly. there's definitely there's a lot of angst there, a lot of mistrust between these two sides. That dates back to something, and nobody will get into specifics about what it is, which is kind of the problem of covering this particular story. This is, you know, we talked about this issue on your podcast a few weeks ago, and my first reaction is the same as it was when we last discussed it. You know, there's a lot of people that are talking on the record about things that they won't specify, and I don't have a lot of patience with that. People have had full reign to get into whatever it is that they claim that Steve Malik did improperly or wrong or whatever when he was during his tenure on the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors over the last year, vis-a-vis his joint status as an owner of the NASL. But nobody's actually said anything specific. So, and they've had ample opportunity to do so, including most recently this letter today. What this came across to me, there's really twofold to the letter today. One is a general and perennial dissatisfaction by the NASL with the composition of not just the pro council, but also how members or two members are chosen from the pro council to serve on the board of directors. And the relatively accurate statement that MLS essentially has a majority share of not just the pro council, but vis-a-vis that, who gets to serve on the board of directors through the pro council, with undoubtedly some influence by the president of U.S. Soccer. I'm sure that there's some influence there. And that's something that has been complained about for years. Those in the MLS side will point out that MLS's presence and influence in the professional soccer ranks is such that they should have a majority share, that other leagues should not be able to outvote MLS. Others will say, you know, MLS should have maybe a plurality of the pro council representation, and not, you know, it's a very Byzantine formula that goes into how the voting is allocated on the pro council. But no matter how it shakes out, MLS has control. And so that, there is a legitimate issue to be discussed there. But all of that part of the letter are complaints that NASL has issued for years, dating back well before 2013. I mean, Bill Peterson, former commissioner of the league, used to talk about this all the time. And the added complaint was that no representative from the NASL who serving on the pro council, which used to be Bill Peterson, was one of the two pro council representatives who were chosen to serve on the board of directors. It was always Don Garber and somebody else. It was Don Garber and Merritt Paulson for a while, and then Don Garber and Alex Papadakis. And now, most recently, Steve Malik. So the complaints about MLS's influence and essentially veto power have been issued for years. The only new part of this letter and why it would be promulgated now is the broadside against Steve Malik, which appears to be an ongoing effort by both the league, more specifically Rocco Commisso, to take out any kind of ill will that he has against Steve Malik. which the best that they've been able to describe both in this letter and before is that he didn't adequately represent NASL's interests on the board, although they have not specified how that is true or even how he could have done that, and they declined to do it again in this letter today. So to me, this letter just smacked of more recriminations between those two sides. They're not happy with each other, to say the least. And so the NASL decides they wanted to send this letter out and take another sideswipe at Steve Malik. Yeah, and my response on Twitter was just to point out three things. Number one, again, the lack of specifics when given another opportunity to do so. Number two, and I guess more substantively, is the fact that no U.S. Soccer Board of Director member with an interest in a pro league related matter can discuss or even vote on those matters when they come before the board. And that we all knew that, and that whole process has been fleshed out in the NASL's preliminary injunction litigation. So, I mean, their complaints about Steve Malik not acting in the NASL's interest on the board or whatever they're saying he did or didn't do are sort of muted in a way by the fact that neither he nor Don Garber or anybody else on the U.S. Soccer Board of Directors can vote or even be present when those issues are being discussed by the board at large. And so those are my main issues with the letter today, and that's why I tweeted out. I guess my third issue that I did tweet out was the fact that it just seemed like a curious demand coming from what is currently an unsanctioned league, currently involved in a lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But let me ask you this now. North Carolina FC, now depending on if we are still going to have two conferences, I keep hearing grumblings about bringing in a central conference. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's just a rumor right now, and we'll just leave it at that. But as you've said before, you know, you're going to have some big-time matches against Charlotte, Charleston, an old familiar rival from the NASL, Tampa Bay Rowdies, of course, FC Cincinnati, Orlando City B is gone now, Harrisburg, City Islanders, which now they're becoming FC Penn, Red Bulls 2, they'll still be around, Bethlehem Steel will be around. So any road trips, Neil, for the future in the USL? Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Well, we'll see. I don't know. These soccer seasons tend to be kind of long, and this season with the addition of the North Carolina Courage, there tended to be a home game almost most weekends here in Cary. So if NCFC was out of town, then usually the Courage was here playing their own game. And by the time you get to a weekend with no home games, it felt like a breath of fresh air. But, you know, it's possible. I mean, I'll never turn down a trip to Charleston for a good meal, that's for sure. my brother lives in Charlotte, and I go there all the time. And Richmond's not as far away as some people may imagine. So I don't think I'm going to buy. It may break your heart to know that I'm not going to buy any tickets on Amtrak anytime soon. But but we'll see. You know, going back to one other, I guess dovetailing off of that question, and also circling back to the original question, the biggest difference really. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting, you know, when you cover soccer, you end up, you know, kind of compartmentalizing to the beat that you're on. You know, you don't find many writers that go cross league, and even those who do tend to specialize in one area. So while I'm very much aware of USL and what they're doing, having not covered the league, there is a bit of a change. Probably the biggest change, and one that I'm a little apprehensive about, is that while the NASL was certainly too small at 8 to 10 teams, although at one point it was up to 12 to 13 at one time, which is a fairly healthy number, covering a league the size of USL, even when you start divvying it up by conferences, is a bit daunting. And frankly, I wonder if it's just too big. I understand why USL does it, so I'm not going to get into the economics of it or the market factors of why they would do it. But it's just, it's a big league. And sometimes when leagues are too big, it's hard to sort of distill down their identity. And this league is definitely has multiple identities. You've got independent teams. You've got MLS2 teams. You've got a couple of hybrids floating around. You've got a third division that's being incubated. We all like to kind of boil down our coverage into narratives and themes. And I'm going to be curious to try to find out if USL has one, other than this giant monolithic lower division thing, with multiple identities, and therefore not having a dominant one. While the NASL size was too small, it was kind of easy to sort of, you know, distill down the coverage. You know, you had easily identifiable teams, easily identifiable personalities and characters. And I wonder if USL is going to lend itself to that as far as coverage is concerned. So maybe, I don't know if that's inside baseball or not, but that's one other thing I wonder about.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But I will say this, though. I'm just happy that you're still going to be able to cover a club, whether they are in the NASL or the USL. I know this is not the last of it. And hopefully towards the end of the year, we'll bring you Kartik and Nipun Chopra back, I guess, for a last hurrah. Because let's be honest, Neil, everything seems to be intertwined. It's not just the lawsuit. It's not just the U.S. men's national team crashing out of qualifying for the World Cup. Now it's Sunil Gulati's job on the line, as well as his own head. So it just seems everything's intertwined. Do you see it that way?
I think there's people who would like to see it that way. I think the NASL has been pushing a narrative of trying to get an advantageous result in their preliminary injunction or even their lawsuit, intimating that this is some turmoil that Sunil Gulati may not like having swirling around him when he tries to run for president again, if he chooses to do so. And they're not altogether wrong about that. I don't think it's the one thing, though. I think it's a larger piece of a bigger picture. Great things have been accomplished under Gulati, but there's also probably a bit of consternation on the board right now. We've seen hints of that, you know, calling for meetings to discuss the hiring process of the U.S. national team coach and what criteria is going to be used. I mean, Brian Strauss reported that there was a call for that meeting. That's a sign of if maybe not distrust, but certainly concern about the confidence that they have in the president. Usually they've not said a word about it, and now they want to know who's going to do this and how are they going to determine who gets hired. That betrays a certain amount of concern, I think, by the board. And there's a variety of factors. I mean, you know, the board finds itself in, you know, two or three separate pieces of litigation right now. One on solidarity payments through the Court of Arbitration for Sport. You've got Miami FC's CAS claim. You've got an antitrust lawsuit from the NASL. You've got a number of other concerning things, not the least of which is the U.S. national team not qualifying for the World Cup. So I think the NESL thing is one part of a big picture that is of concerning to not just U.S. soccer fans in general, but I think it is of some concern to the board. And I think without Sunil Gulati committing to where he's going to run or not, I think it's the first time that you're not only seeing opposition to his reelection, but you're seeing a large contingent of people throwing their hat in the ring. So, yeah, there's certainly worries all around, and I think the NASL lawsuit is one part of that. maybe just a symptom of a larger concern, I'd say.
Yeah, that's what seems to be. I mean, right now I think we're in a level, or we're somewhere probably in no man's land right now. There's so much going around that we're just going to have to wait and see what the answers are. And, of course, the other wonderful moment, of course, is the money laundering scandal through FIFA.
Yeah.
That's also going on in Brooklyn. So
yep.
We'll have to wait and see. But, Neil, thank you again for joining me. I'm glad you had a good Thanksgiving. Thanks for your time, as always. And I will talk to you hopefully before the end of the show season. So have a good night, sir.
Thanks, Daniel. Anytime. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well. Neil Morris, WRALSportsFan.com, his Inverted Triangle Soccer podcast. It's just been a great show. Great show. I listen to it all the time. And, you know, he's got some great guests on. That's why I was able to get Mr. Bank on to discuss the whole NESL lawsuit, of course, an update if there was one that was possible. So I want to thank Neil Morris for having Professor Stephen Bank on his show, and that's how I was able to have him on my show. So thanks again to Mr. Neil Morris for that. You know, just to finish off the show talking about the whole Columbus situation, It's just been really strange to see what we are seeing these days with this potential move to Austin, Texas. It's really weird and strange, and it never thought it ever happened. And I'm still shocked that the league is still allowing it to happen. And I'd like to know what everyone, you know, is thinking about over not just in Austin, Texas, because, you know, let's be honest, it sounded like Austin Aztecs ownership are thinking about coming back in 2019. Don't know if that will really happen. We all know, obviously, if you're from San Antonio, you're not happy about the whole situation of what's going on and how it's been going on. And, you know, I don't blame you guys if you do think about it. But, you know, once again, this entire situation with Columbus Crew moving to Austin, now obviously not you know, by choice, more of by force. And I wouldn't be surprised if there would be some backlashing going on. Now, obviously, there are reports coming about, you know, in Austin, if there is some form of, I guess, shall I say, I guess not sure or not being, you know, on the same page with Mr. Precourt, that it might go to a public election of a vote of some sort with the township or with the people who live in Austin of where, you know, if this is going to go through or not. And all I can say is that's something Mr. Precourt doesn't want. So if that could be the big negativity that goes against Precourt, then, you know, there you have it, and maybe the Crew remain in Columbus. All I can say is that there is tons and tons of issues that we probably don't even know what's going on right now. Even that I don't know what's going on right now, and I wish I did, but I don't. But, I mean, if I do find out, obviously I'll pass it along. But once again, we are seeing, and as I've said already to Neil Morris, we are seeing a situation right now where the soccer wars all I can say is that we are in dire times now with U.S. soccer. And it's not just U.S. soccer now, it's also club soccer. We are in dire times. Everything seems to be falling apart. So all I can say is it's just a situation where I believe that, you know, it's getting to a point where everything might become intertwined. I think it's bad timing. for the whole Columbus situation. MLS is not acting in good faith. And it's a situation where it's tough to see what's going to happen. I truly don't know what the future will be. And I try not to assume I know what's going to happen. I'm just going to ride it out like the rest of you. We're going to have to wait and see what's going to happen with this entire situation. And at the same time, we're going to have to find out why these things are going to happen and how it's going to happen and when it does happen, because there's a lot of questions that have not been answered, in my opinion. We already know the big question that has been answered. Anthony Precourt wants to move the Columbus Crew to Austin, Texas. It was all part of his plan. And I just think the way he has done this whole situation has been poor and it has been terrible. So all I can say is that it is just absolutely ridiculous and asinine that we're having this situation now. Also ridiculous and asinine to see Anthony Precourt not open every single gate of Columbus Crew to let the public in to go to their seats. That is intentional. That is intentional suicide, in my opinion. And that should be shouted out and shouted down against MLS and Mr. Precourt, because that's not right and that's not fair. I just find it ridiculous, but what are you going to do? But all I can say is that I hope, I really, really, truly hope that we will get some answers later on down the road, if there are any. And I just hope we can all have some common sense, and I just wish we can just, you know, fix some of these things before we have worse issues in front of us. So that's where I'm coming from in this. And I just, like I said, there's a lot of issues that we're not aware about. People are going to get hurt down the road. And it's not just that. It's also everything involving this whole lawsuit with the NASL and U.S. Soccer Federation. I really do hope, that those clubs that are watching, waiting to see what's going to happen, let's hope that they can find ways to get something done. And hopefully, these clubs that have, that they've come around to, and they've done great things, in their community, hopefully they will find a home if the NASL does not remain alive. That's all it is. I know some of you are not happy with the NASL. Some of you think the NASL, put themselves in this position, which is probably true. But still, though, it doesn't mean it makes it right for players to lose a paycheck or an employee of those clubs to lose a paycheck. They really, really need to find a way to continue on. And if it is the United Soccer Leagues, then so be it. If it is this NISA through Peter Wilt, then so be it. I just hope that... I'm just hoping that we can just get some form of peace and just go back to what we need to do, and that is to promote the game and, worry about the future later on. So we'll see what happens then. But I want to thank my guests for tonight, Professor Stephen Bank from the UCLA Law School, and, of course, Neil Morris, WRAL sports fan, talking about what's going on in the game in the United States. My name is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening tonight. And as always, please, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Talk to you all next time, and bye-bye for now. Take care. So long, everybody.